The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. And last time, we stopped in the middle of the article Hannah and Anne. And Frank, that is. I'm going to read. This was the last sentence or paragraph last week, and I'll read it just to get our memories back together. In Hamburg, my grandfather saw packs of Nazi brown shirts, the paramilitary of the party, storm Jewish-owned shops in the center of the city, shattering glass storefronts, hurling merchandise onto the pavements, and beating Jewish residents. Hordes of people screamed and chanted while hurling stones through the stained glass windows of synagogues and setting them on fire. Some Jews tried to rescue Torah scrolls from synagogues before they burned. Across Germany, between November 9 and 10, similar scenes of chaos and destruction played out. Our synagogue in Berlin, closed 2 years prior by the Nazis, was burned to the ground, along with 1,000 others across the country. Firefighters were instructed by the authorities not to extinguish the flames of burning synagogues unless they endangered adjacent buildings. It was first referred to as a pogrom, P-O-G-R-O-M, the name used for attacks on Russian Jews during the time of the Tsars. But soon it was called Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. On the morning of November 10, my grandfather called his son to ask if he could safely make it home to Berlin. Uncle Hans answered cryptically, "You have a granddaughter who has a birthday in 2 days." My grandfather understood the meaning of his words, "Go to Amsterdam." So that's how he ended up on our step, with the same small overnight suitcase he had packed for Hamburg. Suddenly a refugee, my grandmother, still back in Berlin. My grandfather was a well-respected lawyer, known for winning the libel trial against Count von Reventlow, who promoted the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an infamous anti-Semitic document. Like all other Jewish lawyers in Germany, my grandfather had been officially barred from the profession just 2 months earlier. He found out later, while he was on his way to us in Amsterdam, the Gestapo had gone looking for him at his office. That night, we heard U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt on the radio condemning the attacks. He said, "The news of the last few days from Germany has deeply shocked public opinion in the United States. Such news from any part of the world would produce a similar profound reaction among American people in every part of the nation. I myself could scarcely believe that such things could occur in a 20th century civilization." My German friends and I heard our parents discussing Kristallnacht, reeling from what felt like a blow to their last shreds of hope that Germany might wake up from its stupor and return to being the decent, cultured place to which they felt so deeply connected. We learned that about 100 Jews had died as a result of the violence. In the Netherlands, the welcoming atmosphere my family experienced in 1934 was beginning to shift now that the number of Jewish refugees was swelling so quickly. In our family, we were happy and relieved when my grandmother came to join my grandfather, moving into an apartment close by. Meanwhile, Edith Frank's mother, Rosa Hollander, had arrived from Aachen, A-A-C-H-E-N, Aachen, Germany, and was living at Anne's home. Our neighborhood felt like it was overflowing with the new arrivals. In the buildings of Merwillerplein Square alone, there were more than 100 Jews, many of them German refugees. My parents and grandparents talked about how worried they were for friends and relatives still in Germany, who sent harrowing accounts of their attempts to find refuge anywhere in the world. Anne's uncles, Walter and Julius Hollander, fled after Walter spent weeks at a concentration camp in Berlin. Having been captured as part of a Gestapo raid of well-to-do Jews, her mother's brothers made it to a town near Boston. But it was becoming difficult to get visas anywhere, in particular the United States. The Netherlands was safe for Jews, but because of restrictive immigration policies for many, it could only be a way station rather than a place to settle. Having a passport and therefore citizenship for any other country at all was a very useful asset for anyone escaping Germany. After 1938, as many as 50,000 German-speaking Jews applied to enter the Netherlands. About 7,000 were permitted in most given only temporary refugee status, with the understanding they were to find other countries to settle in. Between 1933 and 1939, about 33,000 Jewish refugees arrived in the Netherlands. And by the time the Germans invaded, there were around 20,000 still living there. Those who had arrived from Germany felt increasingly anxious, and we kids did pick up on it. But school and birthday parties and friendships and fallings out loomed just as large, if not larger, in our world than dictators and pogroms. And so my relatively sheltered life sailed on. The Jewish holidays helped anchor us against the growing tide of fear and anxiety. Although they were not observant, the Franks would still join us for a festival meal, as did the Liedermans, whose daughter Suzanne Sane for short, rounded out our preteen trio. I think they liked learning about the holiday traditions and perhaps found the cycle of the year, the old customs, reassuring. We were living in modern times, yes, but also followed the lunar Jewish calendar, rooted in the ancient accounting of the seasons. We marked every holiday with its accompanying foods and traditions. There were apples dipped in honey for a sweet new year during Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and cheesecakes on Shavuot, when it is customary to eat dairy to mark this harvest holiday. In the narrow garden space behind our apartment block, we built a makeshift shelter each autumn to mark the week-long holiday Sukkot. We are instructed to have our meals there during the holidays as a way to remember we were once people wandering in the Sinai Desert. My father would tell us to look through the branches covering the Sukkah so we could see the stars. Look up, he told us. This is how we remember that as challenging and frightening moments in life can be, just as the children of Israel found their way through the wilderness with God's help, so will we. The Franks were our regular guests for Shabbat dinner. Otto, fully secular, never learned Hebrew, but he heard the prayers so many times at our table that he'd memorized them, and he could join in. Edith, who grew up in a more traditional Jewish home, a little Freudian slip, keeping kosher and attending synagogue, appreciated the ritual and the familiarity of the Shabbat meals. At the table, set with shimmering silver candlesticks, a silver wine goblet, and the traditional challah, a braided egg bread set under a white satin cloth, Anne and I always sat next to each other, giggling about something until we rose together when my father recited the Kiddush, the blessing for the ritual wine. This was a time to try to unwind from the stress of everyday life and the gathering storm of anti-Jewish violence and persecution in Germany, which we followed through radio and newspaper reports and detailed letters from relatives and friends still there. I know that for the adults it was hard to forget about it for a long time, but the closest they came was here in our snug Amsterdam apartment. Shabbat candles growing, the crystal wine glasses clinking a toast to Lashem, to life. It was good to be in the company of close friends, and it was good to be in Holland, everyone agreed, as we passed around the roast chicken and noodle kugel. Toward the end of August 1939, the newspaper headlines were full of reports that Joseph Stalin, the Soviet leader, had signed a non-aggression pact with Adolf Hitler. My parents were concerned, they told me, because everyone knew Hitler wanted to invade Poland, a move he knew could trigger war. It was the end of the school holidays, and I was enjoying the long days outside, playing with Anne and San, Sena, and our other neighborhood friends. But when, on September 1, 1939, Germany invaded Poland, it was impossible not to feel the tension and dread. We all followed the news closely, fearing what might come next. 2 days later, Britain and France declared war. Everyone I knew had hoped war could be avoided, but we also wanted Hitler stopped. The Netherlands declared itself neutral. We were going to stay out of this, just like during World War I. Ours was a tiny country with a small army that had limited fighting power. There was no chance that, even if the Dutch wanted to do their part and fight the Germans, they could hold up for long against such a massive foe. I think that should have been could have. Or couldn't hold up for long against such a massive foe. I woke up in the pre-dawn darkness of my bedroom, confused by a low rumbling sound, growing louder, building a roar. Is it thunder, I thought? At nearly 12 years old, I was perhaps getting a little old to run to my parents when I was scared in the night, particularly now that I knew I was going to be a big sister. My mother was pregnant with a much-longed-for second child due in the autumn. But still, I darted out of bed and raced to their room. I curled up close to my mother. "Shh," she said, pulling me closer. The morning light was just beginning to seep in. My father pulled back the curtains to look outside. The noise was not thunder. "It's planes," he said. I looked at my parents. They were people of action, yet in the moment they appeared paralyzed. This was almost as frightening to me as the roaring planes. Eventually, one of them turned on the light and then the radio in the living room. There were messages from the government: stay indoors, close the curtains, do not stand by the windows. I was still only half awake, but I could feel my heart pounding, full of fear. It was Friday, May 10, 1940. The German Luftwaffe was attacking the Schiphol Airport. S-C-H-I-P-H-O-L. Schiphol, I'm going to call it. Airport, a main civilian and military airfield about 10 miles southwest from us. Warplanes swarmed low in the sky, seeming to hover one over the other. They flew so low in some areas that people could see the swastikas on their wings. It was a massive show of force. No declaration of war had been received by the neutral Dutch government. The Germans simply started bombing, paratroopers following immediately after the aerial bombardment. They wanted to show us they were here. The dreaded invasion, dismissed far-fetched by most Dutch, had come. My father was afraid that, as a former government official who had opposed the Nazi Party, he could be a target once the Germans arrived. He started sorting through the folders he had brought with him from Berlin, his eyes scanning through various pages and documents for articles he wrote critical of Hitler and the Nazis, and any other potentially incriminating material. "We have to get rid of these," he said to my mother, who joined him, piling papers together in a stack and then ripping them into small pieces. "Hanalei, we need your help. It's going to be your job to flush these pieces of paper down the toilet," Mama instructed me. "Not too many at a time, though." I nodded, baffled by my mission, but determined to help. I took the ripped-up pages, some of them embossed with stamps and calligraphy, others crammed with typewritten words, and with a trembling hand dropped them into the toilet basin. I tried to focus on my task, but my mind raced. Could my father be arrested? Would he be punished severely? We knew of concentration camps for political prisoners like Dachau. We did not know what happened there exactly, only that it was nothing good. "Oh no," my mother groaned, "Otto Braun." She was pointing to the large bust of Otto Braun, my father's former boss, once one of the most powerful men in the Weimar Republic, perched in a corner of the living room. It had come to us from Berlin 6 years ago, a physical reminder of another era. But it now appeared to my parents as incriminating evidence. So Braun's likeness, bald head, bushy eyebrows, round glasses cast in bronze, was dragged down two flights of stairs by my father, my mother assisting, and I looked on with confusion as the symbol of a revered figure in my father's life was unceremoniously shoved into the street. I wondered what the neighbors would think of this, but when I looked around, I was stunned to see the pavement piled up with destroyed papers and discarded books. People were pouring onto the streets with armfuls of whatever they thought might get them into trouble. Anything the Germans might find suspect or forbidden. "It all has to go," one man said as he dumped his trove into a bin. We were glued to the radio. It became clear that the Dutch military, outgunned and outmanned, was having an impossible time staving off the overwhelming German assault. Rotterdam was under heavy bombardment that day, and it sounded like the entire city would be completely flattened. There were reports of casualties, and the numbers were rising. All of the Netherlands shuddered. Black smoke curled into the sky from oil supplies at the port in Amsterdam being destroyed by Dutch authorities before the Germans could capture them. We could smell the smoke in South Amsterdam. By the next day, we were plastering blackout paper on the windows as the punishing air raids by now injuring hundreds continued on Rotterdam. On May 13, we were devastated to hear that the royal family of the Netherlands had sailed to Britain. The security establishment could no longer guarantee their safety, so they fled. Fled. It was like a betrayal. Within hours, it emerged that the Dutch government, the Prime Minister and his cabinet, had also escaped to Britain by boat. Like everyone in Holland, we were overcome to hear they had left us alone in the clutches of the Germans. 5 days was all it had taken for our small country to be overrun. The Dutch surrendered. I was sick to my stomach when I saw the first German soldier on our streets, some careening around corners in motorcycles with sidecars, kicking up clouds of dust. I rushed back inside. From the window, I stared at the rows and rows of young men, gray-uniformed, helmet-wearing, Wehrmacht soldiers, rifles in hand, marching through the Rivenbert in precise step. There were so many of them. They seemed so tall and strong. They sang, "We will soon be marching into England." I understand that when they were saying that, I understood what they were saying and felt ashamed we came from the same country. There was a surreal feeling during those days. We felt the presence of the Germans everywhere, but at the same time, life went on. To our surprise, cautious relief, the weeks following the invasion were quiet and fairly uneventful, and we resumed daily life with less anxiety. Anne and I returned to the Montessori school, now in the sixth grade. Despite the eerie normality there was in the air of desperation among everyone in our community, the adults were all working every lead, every connection around the globe, hoping to find an exit route. I think every German Jew must be combing the world in search of a refuge and not finding one anywhere, Edith Frank wrote to a German Jewish friend in Buenos Aires. The uncertainty and stress were hard, especially on my parents and grandparents. Much as they tried to shield me from their worry and distress, at least we had our community, the cocoon of support among the Franks and other good friends and neighbors. Otto Frank was fond of saying the Allies were going to win. We had to hold on. They'd certainly defeat the Germans. He was the clear-sighted, calm optimist in our circle, a foil to my father's less sunny outlook. In the meantime, my grandparents, parents, and the Franks were scrambling for a way to get out of Holland, pulling every well-placed connection they had. However, the American consulate in Rotterdam, which processed the visa applications in the country, were among the buildings bombed and burned during the German invasion. That meant all applicants, the Franks included, had to resubmit their paperwork. Like other Jews, they were walking a difficult line, trying to create the impression they could support themselves financially in America, while also trying to get across how dire their situation was in Holland. The U.S. State Department wasn't the refuge many had hoped. Officials were stonewalling, hiding behind claims that refugees might include communists and spies. The Jews could, they said, become a destabilizing force within America. U.S. consular offices in Europe, like the one in Rotterdam, denied hundreds of thousands of people who applied from 1933, when Hitler was put in power, to 1945, when the war ended. American rabbi Stephen Wise, who oversaw lobbying efforts for immigration from within the United States Jewish community, called this death by bureaucracy. There was no escaping that things in Amsterdam were getting worse. The same month my sister Gabby was born, and 5 months after the German invasion of the Netherlands, the first anti-Jewish restrictions were ordered. The strange, surreal calm was broken as we started to realize the Germans' so-called velvet glove approach in Holland was by design intended to deceive us into thinking that there was such a thing as a benign German occupation. There was a ban on kosher slaughter, which meant in our observant household we could no longer eat meat. Jews were not permitted in hotels, restaurants, or other recreational facilities. We were also given a 2-month deadline with which to register with the authorities. Our identity cards were now marked with a large J, identifying us at a quick glance as Jews. Most people complied, fearing retaliation if they did not. The Germans declared it illegal for the Dutch to listen to foreign or Dutch broadcasting organizations, including Radio Free Orange, the radio station of the Dutch government in exile in England. As my parents were both English-speaking, like many others, they had relied on the BBC for up-to-date information. They felt suddenly cut off, imprisoned in a harrowing new reality. Soon, most of what was there to listen to was Nazi, or so-called Aryan programming, propaganda. It wasn't long before Jews were forbidden to own radios at all. With no radio and Dutch newspapers under German control publishing only censored approved reports and Nazi propaganda, people had to rely on word of mouth for information. Some of it was based on illegal listening to British and American broadcasts or reading underground uncensored papers. That was the only way to glean what was really happening. The process of identifying and isolating Jews within Dutch society had begun. By early February 1941, things started feeling even scarier. Just 15 minutes from our apartment, an ice cream parlor popular with German Jewish refugees was raided by German soldiers. And when customers doused themselves with ammonia, the soldiers opened fire in return. Rather, when customers doused them, that is the German soldiers, with ammonia, the soldiers returned fire in return. One of the Jewish owners of the ice cream shop was executed by firing squad, and the Germans decided to make a sweep of arrests of men in the now sealed-off Jewish quarter. We heard that Jewish men were plucked off bicycles at random and dragged from apartments and then pushed to the ground, beaten, sometimes in front of their children. Nearly 400 men were arrested and forced to assemble on Jonas Daniel Meijerplein, a central square in the Jewish quarter, and were loaded onto trains across the border to Germany, to the concentration camps of Mauthausen and Buchenwald. The only information we had was that people were being sent to camps in the east. And we have to stop there. Oh, we've run out of time. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Keppen family, and we wish to thank them. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed this reading, although it was rather harsh to listen to. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.